Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to The Exchange Live. My name is Paul Hill, and I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished global fund manager Patrick Armstrong of Plarini Wealth Management. So welcome, Patrick.
Good morning.
Well, big congrats on your fund's returns over this year and previous years. But before we sort of run through your sort of view for the market going forward, I don't suppose you could just quickly remind the audience what kind of investor you are, what kind of stocks you like.
Sure. So in terms of equities, we use an AI and machine learning system to help us select stocks. So we've been using that since 2017. We launched our strategy that formally employs it in 2018. And we've designed a process where we use our machines to harvest massive amounts of data on thousands of companies every single day. And it looks for things that humans have always looked for as investors. So companies that are cheap, companies that are growing, companies that have momentum in terms of analyst expectations and revisions and their own profitability. So we're trying to use cutting edge technology to develop something that's very traditional in what it's looking for. We don't think humans have been looking for the wrong things. We just think humans are overwhelmed with information overload, and machines are really better suited to identify the characteristics that really human analysts and fund managers have been looking for decades.
Are those sort of like just like supercharged sort of stock filters, stocks assert screeners, or is it actually you're putting further external data in rather than just from your data providers? Is it something that other people can replicate, or is it really quite proprietary?
So all the information we have, people could replicate, and they could do that as a filter or an algorithm. What we've been doing is not just filtering and not just algorithmically, letting the machines decide the weighting and what matters on all the measures. So I think quite easily, if you had access to a FactSet, Bloomberg, Morningstar, you could feed all the PEs, or if you even a lot of websites give you these kind of things quite well now. But what the machine learning bit is it decides which factors are relevant for which stocks and which type of market regime we're in. So sometimes valuation is very important. Sometimes it's revisions that are very important, or relative performance and relative revisions. It's all those things. That's where the machine learning bit comes in. So information is readily available, and it's just the ability to process information systematically, consistently. I do think it is a democratization in terms of information flow, where it used to be really hard to have access to information. Regulation full disclosure meant companies can't disseminate anything anymore that's material selectively. It has to be disseminated widely. But on the other side of things, there's just so much information every day coming out, and thousands of companies, it's very hard to keep up with it. So it's not about finding information that no one else knows. It's just about processing that and using that as part of your investment process, I think, where you get an edge these days.
Yeah. And that's really given you your alpha, because I did notice on your return since inception, you've beaten the market, haven't you? Which is pretty good performance.
It's a pretty consistent outperformance. On our long strategy, we're beating the MSCI World by about 5% per annum since we launched it in 2018. On the short side, we've actually not made any returns on the short since we launched it in 2019, but that's beating the market by 6% a year, a little over that, because we're almost flat, but the markets had a big bull run over that period. So preserving value on the shorts is actually a relative alpha position. So we've made money on the longs and the shorts relatively. When we put them together in our long short, it's led to very strong risk-adjusted returns.
Brilliant. And what's your sort of more broadly, what's your sort of view of the markets sort of going forward for? I mean, we've only got like 4 or 5 months left, but unfortunately, as we all know, autumn can be quite volatile. My mind goes back to the 12th of October, 1987 from when I was at school. But what's your sort of view for the markets for the next 12 months? Because certainly the S&P 500 is trading at forward multiple of roughly around about 21 times. It's baking in 13-14% EPS growth and margin expansion, which in a slowing US economy seems quite a sort of like optimistic scenario.
It's an optimistic scenario. And if you ever look at forecast margins, they're always forecast to expand on a consensus basis. Reality obviously doesn't end up that way. But over the last 20 years, it has been very consistent that year on year, profit margins have increased. And that's due to a function of the profitable top end of the market, that you've got a company like NVIDIA that had a very small weight in the MSCI world 3 years ago. Now it's the second biggest weight, and it's generating 50% profit margins on a full cost accounting. So companies that used to be the dominant companies, like Exxon used to sell $100 of revenue and make $2 of profit. Now you've got NVIDIA, who's $100 of revenues, eking out $50 of profit on it. So it's a function of services economy, function of technology, productivity, that margin expansion probably will continue on the tech-oriented companies. It's hard to see with the consumer where we're at to see general margin expansion in the traditional side of industries, but they're trading at much lower multiples as well.
And do you think there is going to be a soft landing rather than a hard landing, or sort of like a sort of technical recession? Because we have just seen today, I saw it on Bloomberg, that after 793 days, the US yield curve has finally re-inverted. Yes. And it's zero. It's flat, the twos and the tens, which is usually a very good signal of an impending recession. But what's your sort of view on the economics?
Yes. So historically, that's almost always indicated a recession's imminent, because you get the leading indicator of a future recession, the inversion. And as you come out of that, that's because the Fed's usually backpedaling on cuts where they went too far. And this time, I think Powell may have played it pretty well, that he's going to be cutting, not because we're in a recession, which all historically central banks, that's the mistake they've made. They've kept the hikes on a little bit too long, waited for signs that we're into a recession, that inflation was already moving below their targets. Then they began cutting. I think Powell's played it well enough that the September cut that's coming, we're not in the midst of a recession right now. The employment market is key, and we've got a big number on that coming out today. The U.S. consumer is what drives the U.S. economy, and a fully employed consumer that's getting a wage growth that's outstripping inflation is a pretty powerful backdrop. And I still think we are in that soft landing scenario where unemployment's ticked up to 4.3% last month. The survey has it coming down to 4.2 today. Wage growth is outstripping inflation. Inflation's falling below 3%. Wage growth at 4%. That is fueling disposable income growth. And that sets up a pretty powerful backdrop, if I'm right on the macro side of things, on the economy. If you do have a cutting Fed putting monetary stimulus into the market at a time when economic growth isn't contracting, that sets up a year-end rally, in my opinion.
Right. Okay. So, and the sort of the GDP growth, which is sort of like expected to be sort of like 1 to 1.5% across Europe, the UK and Europe, is going to be sufficient, is it, to drive 13-14% EPS growth for next year?
No, but I always
sorry, that was the killer question.
Yeah, it just never is. Consensus is just always too optimistic by design. And if you look at the numbers, you always think the market's expecting too much. But the reality is, real investors, I think, are taking the consensus numbers with a grain of salt, knowing they get revised down in the quarters that lead up to the actual results, and then the companies beat on the new lowered numbers. And as long as you're generating 6% earnings growth. I think we're with that kind of economic backdrop, I think that is plausible given the share buybacks, given efficiency gains, and you are getting real economic growth too. So nominal economic growth is more like 3 to 4% if you are getting the 1.5% real growth as well. So okay, you think about earnings in nominal terms, GDP growth is a real number generally, but in nominal terms, that is a pretty powerful backdrop.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay, good. If anybody wants to ask Patrick any questions, then please put them into the chat bot and I'll read them out. We've had just a broad one on the sort of Steve Lewis. It's just on the banks. And I know you own Barclays, Patrick, and he's asking about one savings bank, OSB. I just want, just broadly, what's your view of UK banks and a bit more specifically on on Barclays, because I know it's now got a new CEO in there about 18 months, done a lot of restructuring, and I think they're still sort of like aiming to go for sort of low double digit sort of net tangible asset, sort of, well, return on net tangible assets in the longer term.
Exactly. I think that sets up a case where banks in aggregate are cheap. They are exposed to the economy. If we do go into an environment of defaults on loans, that's a big risk for banks, obviously. And in my scenario, we don't fall into a recession this year anyway. Stocks trading at 40% of tangible book value that are generating double-digit returns on that equity, that's pretty attractive backdrop. So we own Barclays in our UK strategy. We own Citibank in our global strategies, both of them very similar. They're both broad-based. They have their mortgage banks, their commercial banks, investment banks. And I'm not pounding the table saying this is an incredible buy, but those banks are fairly priced given what their returns are. And there is double-digit returns from these kind of banks without a lot of valuation risk, definitely. The cyclical risk doesn't come from a small recession. It comes from a big recession. And I'm pretty confident that the central banks have so much dry powder that you can really not dismiss, but you don't have to worry about a massive recession right now, given where government spending is, given where employment is, and given central banks have so much dry powder to cut if they need to, and they've said they've got a real willingness to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm very comfortable to own those stocks that are trading at such undemanding multiples.
Yeah, and just in the UK, I mean, yeah, I would agree. I think there's sort of overall the central bank should be fairly supportive or will be supportive of the banks. But unfortunately, we now have a chancellor, Rachel Reeves, who has been sort of identified as potentially doing a windfall tax on the banks. Do you think that will happen, or what's
I don't think so. And if it does happen, I suspect it's a soundbite without a lot of real economic implications. But whenever you do have a really strong majority for one party, the risks are you can move to a little bit more extreme because you don't have some of the checks and balances that a very close parliament would put in place.
Yeah. And also just turning to one savings bank, OSB, which I think is a buy-to-let bank in the UK. I think it's a FTSE 250. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this one. I mean, I know I think it's been through a few sort of trials and tribulations, but
I can't answer that one off the top of my head because I don't know it very well. Buy-to-let with higher stamp duties on second properties, things like that is a risk as well. But I don't know the bank, so I'm sorry on that one.
Yeah, no, sorry. Likewise, Steve, I don't know it particularly well. You'd have to go through the actual balance sheet, but it looks like a sort of well-balanced sort of consumer deposit bank that that then also does sort of buy-to-let sort of mortgages. But okay, well, let's move on. Let's go through. We've got some on the medical side. Let's go through the GLP-1 drugs because I know you've. I understand you've just sold a very long term winner for you, Novo Nordisk, and actually got into Roche, which is more oncology and diagnostics. But a little birdie also tells me it's got a phase one GLP-1 little drug coming. So what's the sort of strategy behind there of switching out of a really good long-term winner into a stock that started now to improve, but still got obviously a lot ahead of it?
Yeah, with Novo Nordisk, it's been an incredible performer for us. It's been incredible revenue growth on its obesity and diabetes side of things. But it's not priced for perfection, but it's priced that it's really going to carve out what it has right now and sustain that of an oligopoly position with Eli Lilly. And with Roche, you've got a potential new competitor coming in on this space. And it won't just be Roche, but Novo Nordisk is an expensive company, a great company. Roche is an inexpensive company that has the potential to really surprise. It's had some really good indications on cancer, oncology, and the obesity side of things is another little potential growth. If nothing good happens there, it's trading at 15, 16 times earnings, paying you a nice dividend yield in Swiss franc, and there is upside. So I view Roche as a call option on potential upside with a pretty fair valuation just from ongoing cash flow, whereas Novo Nordisk, there is risk that as competition comes in, you're going to see a lower multiple on that, and maybe they don't meet all the estimates that analysts and consensus are pricing in there.
Yeah, I understand actually on Roche next week, there was a big industry conference at diabetes, I think, in Europe, and they're hoping to reveal all their first phase data on that that phase one trial for the new GLP-1 for Roche. So that could actually be a nice catalyst, I guess.
It could be. They've historically disappointed in this one, but I think the stock's at a multiple where people are expecting to be disappointed, and those quite often are stocks that are frustrating to be in, but then they have big jumps when something good happens. And that's where Roche's pipeline has been. It's been years of being disappointing. But on cancer and weight loss, diabetes, these things are showing potential that they could come up with some very good news that the market could latch on to. So that was our thinking on that switch.
Okay, good. And just more broadly, just on the sort of the whole AI sort of like a Mag7 sort of stocks, how are you viewing those? Because obviously they've had such good runs over the last 2 or 3 years. Have you been sort of tempted to take profits there? Because I was looking at the PE ratios, which came through from JP Morgan, and the top 10 S&P 500 stocks trade at roughly around about 27 times, 28 times sort of PE. Yeah. Whereas on the rest of the market, it's below 20. So the significant, obviously the growth profile is different, but how do you view sort of valuation and being sort of disciplined in buying and selling?
So I would much rather own these companies than be short them. And we do own pretty much a market weight in them, which is still a massive weight. So in my global portfolio, I've got a 4.3% weight in NVIDIA. The MSCI World has a 4 and change weight in it as well. So I'm not massively overweighted. I like Meta's valuation. I like Alphabet's valuation. I think they're going to continue to buy back shares, continue to generate a lot of free cash flow. So those ones I'm not even worried about the multiple on. We don't own Apple right now. We do have Amazon, which is a play on the consumer. That's an expensive company, but it's very cheap versus its own history as well. I think its own history has been far too expensive in the past potentially, but it has coming down to a multiple that's in the 30s versus 50s and 60s as it really wasn't generating earnings a few years ago. So these are great companies. They're buying back shares that create real strong earnings growth in Apple's case without any real revenue growth or real bottom line growth of the per share basis is really coming through. The new iPhone 16 is always an incremental driver, not just for Apple, but the whole industry. So I'm comfortable with the valuations. They should trade at a premium because they're premium companies. They've got dominant market positions. They have pricing power. They have tons of free cash flow. And it's hard to see anything from competitors disrupting their position. Regulation-wise is always a risk with these things. And you've seen the DOJ put a questionnaire, a subpoena to NVIDIA, that they formally have to answer these questions. And that's sometimes viewed as, well, it is viewed as a first stage in what could turn into anti-competitive practices litigation. But the thing that's going for these companies is it's not their practices that's driving out competition the way Microsoft was in 2000. It's just they've got better products and NVIDIA's processing powers of their GPUs are just what companies are attracted to. It's not that they've really put in place anti-competitive policies, in my opinion. So I think it should be very defendable. Anytime you do have left-leaning governments, it is a risk of regulation, even if it's not fair. Governments don't have to do the fair thing. But I don't think the US is going to want to shoot itself in the foot when it's competing with China. It's going to want to have a very strong innovation and strong technology sector, I think, and it would really be doing a disservice to the whole US if it did really put a lot of regulation on these companies.
Yeah. On the whole AI thing, though, the sort of the key fundamentals risk is that people like, obviously, NVIDIA have been like over-earning and bringing forward sales into these you know, the last 18 months, 2 years, because everybody's just been wanting to build out their training competency, yep, their capacity within their big data centers. And once that settles down, then you're going to see a big reset in terms of valuations, or not, well, certainly on demand, unless there are big revenues coming through from the hyperscalers. I don't know if you want to sort of just talk through that, how you get comfortable as an investor, because you do get sort of exponential demand at the moment, but is that sustainable?
No, nothing's sustainable on the profit margins that they're generating right now, because outsized profits just attracts competition.
Yeah.
But there is such demand for these right now that I do think we have quarters and quarters ahead of us where there is going to be much more demand than there is supply. And we will get into an equilibrium where profit margins come down to something more realistic, revenue growth comes down to something that isn't anything like the 100% we're getting all the time right now. But yeah, that's why they trade at premium multiples. But the multiples, you just need several quarters of these outsized crazy margins and revenue growth. And then you put everything normal in your DCFs from 2 years out, normalizing to basically over a 7 year period. Then that does make sense on these companies with the multiples they're trading at. So I don't think they're pricing in perfection forever. They're pricing in an extended period of really high profits. And I do think that makes sense for these kind of companies.
Yeah. And then you mentioned you didn't own Apple, and presumably you don't own Tesla. I mean, I know Warren Buffett recently sold Apple, didn't he? So you probably beat him to it.
Well, that was actually the switch we made in January, the 5th of January. We sold Apple and bought NVIDIA, because we didn't have NVIDIA for last year. So it was one of our detractors for not owning it the previous year. But on January 5th, it was a real easy decision, in my opinion, that I should have made earlier, maybe. Just if you look at the growth, if you look at the PEs, they were trading at the same PE at the beginning of this year, Apple and NVIDIA. And NVIDIA had a real clear growth path, and Apple had stagnating revenues and earnings. It's been a share buybacks that's really been driving the stock higher over the last few months. But nothing wrong with Apple, in my opinion. I could totally be comfortable to own Apple, but we own 30 stocks portfolios. We don't own everything, and we did the relative assessment of NVIDIA versus Apple in January.
Yeah, and I'm just finishing off the AI side. I understand now you've sold AMD, have you, Advanced Micro Devices, which is a traditional competitor against Intel in sort of like CPUs, microprocessors, but is also developing chips to compete with NVIDIA, but it's equally had a very good run, hasn't it?
It has, and we had NVIDIA, AMD, Applied Materials, and Renesas in July, and we just decided, given regulation risks, given China risks and curtailing revenues into China, we didn't want to have all four of them anymore. So we kept NVIDIA, kept Applied Materials, and we moved out of AMD and Renesas. I would much rather own AMD versus Intel. In our short portfolio, we've been short Intel all year, and it's still in our short portfolio today. AMD we don't own, but that would be a very good pair trade to play out over the next couple of years. Long AMD, short Intel. It's just AMD is winning, and Intel, it's not keeping up, and it's more of the dinosaur, and AMD is just taking its market share, and it has a call option on maybe cutting into the NVIDIA's AI processing data centers as well.
Yeah, just more broadly then, when you sort of go short, how do you identify sort of companies to sort of like, you know, to go short, and also, you know, how do you manage that particular risk? Do you in a pairs trade, or do you hedge some of it, or do you just go sort of naked short?
Everything we do is a naked short in our short strategy. We also have a long short strategy where we combine our long positions with our short positions, and they're not necessarily pair trades, but we do have I do think of it that way sometimes. So we're short Kering right now, which is just mismanaging its brands, delivering no growth. Its Gucci brand is out of favor. And we're long Hermès. So it's not a pair trade necessarily, but it's our AI system that flags this. And it looks at the relative earnings revisions, the valuation, insider buying, insider selling. So all the things you'd think of. And it highlights for me that we should be short Kering, and it's highlighting Hermès, despite the multiple trading at, is much more attractive given its return on equities, its profitability, and its strength of its brands. It's seeing much less slowdown from the China consumer than Kering has, or even LVMH, which downsized its Tiffany store by 50% in China just last week. So we were short LVMH as well in August, but we closed that earlier last month.
So you basically go short on sort of fundamentals rather than sort of like sentiment, because I guess you're not short of Tesla, even though the fundamentals are quite difficult in electric vehicles and the valuation's still quite rich. But because of Elon Musk, he's a bit of a cult stock. Is that correct?
We're not short Tesla. I am short Lucid. And I'm short Rivian. Those are companies that just have very difficult paths to profitability. EVs is a hyper-competitive market. Even Tesla, that's the dominant producer there, has to cut prices to increase sales. So EVs, as it stands right now, it's hard to see any company making outsized profits. Tesla, I'm not short. And our actually system has upgraded it to a buy recently, but we don't own it. It does have more upside than its competitors with its self-driving cars. It does have call options on other things that could really take off that Rivian and Lucid, I'm not so worried about that there. So the EV industry is hyper-competitive. If you do like Tesla, it's not just on the EV. It's carving out a position where it can generate profits where no one else can, and it'll be from ancillary services that come along with the EVs, whether it's a better battery, self-driving cars, things like that.
When you sort of survey the sort of the global economy, do you sort of like watch out for where China has targeted strategically to go into? So, for instance, if you roll the clock back sort of 15, 20 years, you go into solar, you go into chemicals, steel, etc., and they decided, right, okay, we're going to build huge manufacture, overproduce on those, and then dump the actual products in the rest of the world. And they're doing the same with EVs. And is that something you know to be aware of? Do you sort of like anything that the Chinese have targeted a strategic area is going to be a problem to go on the long side?
I've never thought of it that way, but that is definitely a big part of our thinking on the EVs. But maybe you could expand that thinking across multiple sectors, whether it's steel and solar, like you say. If anyone is selling product and not making profitability for whatever reason it is, it's very difficult for its competitors to compete. So Amazon for years and years didn't make any money in the retail side of things, and that really squeezed out competition, but it's good for the consumer. So if you have someone who's got an inelastic pricing methodology that they're either trying to gain market share or serve their country's goals, it does make it a very difficult environment in that sector, obviously.
Yeah. Good. Okay, well, let's switch sectors to sort of payments. We've got international Forex payments firm. We've got Wise in the UK, which I think acts as the sort of the payment rails for lots of banks and fund managers across quite difficult to reach currencies, not just your classic sort of like euro, dollar, yen, etc., but into sort of places like Africa, South America, and this sort of stuff. Seems to be growing quite a lot, but the shares have sort of like, you know, I think they had flat line the last time I saw them. What's sort of your latest on Wise on the payment side?
So we own Wise in our UK equity, in our UK portfolios. We own PayPal in our global strategies where we have more flexibility. They're both trading low teen multiples, mid-teen multiples. They are disruptors in finance. FX has historically been an area where banks make a lot of profitability. Wise is disrupting that on the PayPal side of things at Venmo. I'm comfortable with both of them. PayPal's been a really strong performer for us. Wise, I think, probably hasn't made much money for us this year. It's had some weak earnings as well. But the multiples they trade at, very attractive for the potential of ongoing revenue and probably the profit margins for people who haven't looked at these companies may surprise that PayPal's got a profit margin of at least 40%, maybe even 45%. And they have carved out little niches of profitability, and the multiples don't reflect the profitability of these kind of companies, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would agree. And they're also just introduced, haven't they, PayPal, the fast checkout. They've got their own branded sort of facilities where it's sort of one touch payment, but also they use that sort of third part. They've created third party rails for lots of other online companies called.
And the market really punished them as they were rolling that out last year, because it is lower margin, that part of their business, but it is high revenue growth as well. So you've got your own branded services is combined with the more generic commodity type stuff. Oh, sorry, that's in my office.
Is it you? It obviously likes PayPal, doesn't it, your office? Okay, let's switch sector. We've got another stock that was a turnaround is Rolls-Royce in the UK. Now, that has really sort of rocketed, in fact, over the last 18 months. Had a new CEO, and I think that I remember him saying that the platform was burning at one stage through the FT, and I was having a look round and thinking, crikey, he's going to really kitchen sink the results. But he didn't do that, and actually the shares at that moment really bottomed out. What's your sort of your latest on this one? Because it really has been a very good winner for you.
Yeah, it's the biggest weight in our UK strategy. I don't have it in my global strategy, unfortunately. But yeah, it's been a turnaround story, cost-cutting, efficiencies, benefiting from just economic growth broadly, defense spending, aircraft demand. It's had some issues recently with Cathay Pacific and maybe investigations there. Rolls-Royce has come out and said this is a one-off. It's nothing that will likely lead to further investigations. But it's a company that's trading not at a cheap multiple anymore after the share price performance. But given all of the efficiency gains and real clear revenue growth, I do think this is one we're definitely sticking with. As I said, it's in our biggest weight in our UK strategy. And it's part of a theme that we do like, which is defense spending. We think that's an area that's going to see secular growth, unfortunately, given geopolitical tensions.
Yeah. Another one in that sector, actually, on the defense side is BAE, isn't it? And I know you own. Is that a similar sort of thesis?
We don't own it anymore, actually. We've sold that to Dassault Aviations, and that was one from our AI system that if it was just me, I would be happily sticking with it. But it did flag relative improving consensus numbers out of Dassault, and it did say to BAE was less preferred. So it's not saying short BAE or anything like that, but it is preferring the relative earnings revisions out of Dassault, very similar valuations, and it's the exact same drivers. So it's one we have sold and stayed within the same sector.
Right, okay. And so when it comes to sort of turnarounds, et cetera, then or selling it, you can sort of, you sort of arbitrage between different companies, do you? That's how the sort of system works, is it?
Well, the system just looks at companies and it highlights which ones have winning characteristics, which ones have weakening characteristics, and it will tell me that I should be getting out of a stock. And then if I want to stay in that sector, I choose a stock to go in from the same sector. That's what we did in that instance. We're still completely bullish on the long-term spending on defense. We think they're all priced as cyclical companies, which they are as industrials, but we do think there's very clear spending plans. You have seen some pushback in Germany, maybe in the UK a little bit as well, with the government fiscal strings getting a little bit tighter. But unfortunately, I do think defense is an area that is going to lead to inelastic demand. I think governments really have to increase their spending now that there is war in Europe. I do think that provides the catalyst that continues government spending in this area.
Yeah. And I'm guessing if Trump ever wins the US election, then he's going to be holding NATO's feet to the fire, isn't he? So everybody there has got to up the game to probably 2.5% of GDP. He'll force them to do it.
Yeah, pretty much. I think they know that's a very clear risk. Yeah. That no one's going to be shocked if Trump is elected, that's going to be the conclusion.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to software. We've got UK business, which is called Sage, which does accountancy software, HR gain systems for traditionally small, medium-sized enterprises. Yeah. Been through a bit of a rebound. Main competitors are Intuit in the States and also Xero's, I think, is an Australian business. It's moved to 100% almost SaaS revenue. But the shares have performed pretty well, but have struggled just recently, largely on the back of fears that corporates are transferring some of their IT budgets to AI and they're putting.
And I think that's fair. We haven't come to a decision on this one, whether it will be a beneficiary or it's going to be hurt by AI. So basically, it's definitely got a lot of tools that are going to be difficult, where it can really add in the AI and improve the automation of these kind of things. Mm. But it also does face risks that maybe somebody else comes and pulls the carpet from underneath of them. But they are well positioned, I think, in terms of their customer base, their ongoing revenues. I would really like to see them pull those levers and really get competitive advantage utilizing the AI and these side of things, which I know they're working on. But it is, over recent months, being viewed as at risk from a potential disruption of spending going elsewhere rather than their services.
Yeah. And is there also, I guess, is also a risk, ultimately, if all these bots come out, you know, system bots, then overhead support services for in big corporates, i.e. their customer base, so the finance functions, the payroll, tax functions in corporates, Sage itself, but yeah. You know, they'll obviously reduce the headcounts, and that would mean fewer licenses required, presumably, for their software.
Yeah, it's definitely an opportunity and the threat. It's both sides of that one for Sage, I'd say. Definitely it's something they can embrace and improve with, but it is also going to create the risks that you've just highlighted as well.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to the US consumer. I know we touched on it on the at the start with the sort of the health of sort of the US economy. But let's move to Walmart, which is obviously the world's best or biggest retailer. And I think it bought an AI or e-commerce platform a few years back. And since then, its shares have just done terrifically for an already very sort of, you know, huge business. It's just sort of motored. And what's sort of your latest on this one? Because Dollar Tree and Dollar General out in the States, which are hard discounters, many convenience stores, they've really struggled of late. But Walmart's gone strength to strength.
Yeah, Walmart's really benefiting from economies of scale. CEOs really highlighted it, gains it's made on using AI for efficiency on stocking, ordering, helping its associates be much more efficient than they've ever been in the past about making sure that their shelves are stocked, orders are placed at the right time, tracking trends in buying, those kind of things as well. So it's an environment where we think retail sales are going to continue to be strong, but consumers are going to be thinking about value for money, just because we're not in that booming 20s environment where everything's incredible, but it is a growth environment where there is spending, but I think it's going to be more thoughtful spending. So I think Walmart's very well positioned there. So that's in our global equity portfolio. We've got AB Foods with a similar thought process in the UK side of things, and that's not worked out as well recently, with Primark having weak numbers, which they attribute to weather related, which I think is partially true. Usually I just dismiss that you always pull out of the bag when you need to, but it does seem realistic, and the sugar side of things is largely unforecastable there. But both of those stocks were trying to play the same theme of basically consumer spending continuing, but more thoughtful consumer spending. The lower end of the consumer, we think, is much better positioned than the luxury side of things at this point in time, given what particularly China, the economic headwinds they're facing.
Yeah. I mean, I know AB Foods with Primark is a sort of a discounter on clothes, etc. But would they be sort of like threatened at all by the likes of Temu and Shein and people like that?
I think definitely. Not right now, but in the coming years, it does seem that Temu is a growth, even though it's had a big miss recently. I think if I am right in the cost-conscious shopper. Temu is a natural place to look at as a competition for Primark because it is at that lower end, lower margin side of things. But we do think it is still Primark that's getting the lion's share of these kind of purchases right now. And it's, I don't see that changing rapidly, but yeah. Incrementally it will face competition as every kind of retailer will.
Mm. Just more broadly, why is the sort of the retail, clothes retail, part of the same group as a food ingredients? Am I mad or is that the board's crazy?
I don't know if it's crazy, but it's, yeah, I would probably prefer to have a pure play. We bought it on Primark, really, is what we were attracted to. And the other side of the foods and the sugar side of thing is a bit of a wild card that I find less forecastable. But yeah, generally, you do get a discount as a holding company with when you've got a range of different business lines. And maybe they could unlock some value there, but they've not shown any inclination to be doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's with you. I think that's pure upside, actually. I think they could definitely sort of like see an unbundling opportunity. I mean, so many companies do it. And if there's no synergies between the two, then it doesn't make any sense having them separately, particularly. It all depends, I suppose. Is it the Western family still own BBF, don't they? The big chunk, yeah. Does it?
Yeah, it's not a play on that getting spun out or something, but yeah. That's a possibility always.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's move to consumer travel, which has been a surge since we reopened. And we've got EasyJet, one of the low-cost airlines, them and Jet2 and also Ryanair have done really well over the last few years. But they're actually now has got quite a lot of capacity brought on. Yes, there's more travellers, but prices seem to have sort of like, you know, softened off a touch. What's your sort of your latest on sort of like EasyJet? Is it going to continue to be a winner and as companies still sort of drop out the market because they can't compete against these big guys?
We don't own any of them anymore. So at the beginning of the year, we had Ryanair, we sold that. In our UK portfolio, we had EasyJet and we've sold that. And it was based on the Ryanair outlook and the challenges they're facing in profitability and margins and the competition that really made us and the machines we use to change our minds. That really, you saw consensus really lowering their estimates on profitabilities as these companies have guided lower. So it's something that we sold Ryanair in the spring and EasyJet in the middle of July based on those concerns. So it's a sector that I think is facing a lot of competition. And I don't see how any one of them is really positioned to make outsized profits given the basically, as soon as you raise your prices to something, there's too much competition to get outsized profits.
Yeah. Do you see any opportunity at all in any of the sort of like the consumer-facing sort of travel, leisure, lodging, entertainment type sectors?
We've sold out of all of them. We had another poor one with Las Vegas Sands was another position we had earlier in the year. We've sold that one. Booking.com is one we've looked at a few times. We don't own it, but it's showing pretty reasonable revenue growth there too. We considered that one, but we don't have any position on these in our global equity portfolio right now. So it's something that's not jumping out to me on the short side of things or the long side of things right now.
Because it's discretionary, basically. That's what we're talking about, isn't it? It's sort of like non-essential purchases.
Yeah, it's. I'm not so worried about the spending. I think that's going to continue to be strong. It's just that whenever the consumer is spoiled for choice, those companies have to sell at basically no economic value add. And that's the risk, I think, for these things. That I do think travel and spending will continue, but the profitability customers are showing they're very cost conscious.
Yeah, okay, good. Okay, well, let's move to another one on the financials. We've got traditional spread better, IG Group, which is obviously the idea, does CFDs. Very, very cheap, masses of cash flow. What sort of attracted you to this business?
We've had that one in plus 500 in different portfolios for quite a long time, actually. Yeah. And very strong growth. People watching your podcast like platforms to trade on, I'm sure. And you've probably seen increasing demand there. More and more people are becoming more trading oriented, and IG is a big beneficiary of that. I also like, in a portfolio context, when things get pretty rough in the market, it's nice to have stocks that are beneficiaries of that. And when things get volatile, trading revenues go up. So if things go into a prolonged bear market, that would be bad for IG Index, but a very volatile crash, rebound, that kind of thing, revenues really do well in those kind of markets for these companies.
Yeah, I mean, this one looks, given its cash generation, you'd have thought it'd be sort of, must be the interest of, or peak in the interest of private equity, because Hargreaves Lansdown has just been sort of like bought out, I think, by a private equity guy.
Yeah, it's that's a good point on this one, because the multiples are undemanding, the growth is very steady, and it's not that it's just had a few good quarters, it has had a long trend of pretty good performance on revenues, earnings, and share price even as well.
Yeah. Okay, good. If anybody, just reminder, if anybody wants to ask Patrick a question, then please put them into the chat box. Just on a recent purchase, you've got ServiceNow, I understand, which you can take us through what it does. I think it's a software company out in the States, one of the world's biggest, isn't it?
Yeah, so cloud efficiencies, we talked about Sage, that's what ServiceNow, very similar side of things. It's when we did move out of semiconductors.
Yeah,
I'm 9% underweight technology right now, actually, but I'm overweight communications. So Facebook, Meta, Alphabet are in communications. And I really didn't want to get more underweight technology. And ServiceNow is a stock that's basically seeing very predictable revenue growth. It's got ongoing contracts and its efficiency potential improvements using AI, all of those things. And the multiple, it's not a cheap stock by any means, but it's not more expensive than other technology companies. So it is relatively cheap given the services revenue there. So that's one we have added, moving away from the semiconductors into the software side of things, a bit less cyclicality than a semiconductor stock as well.
Okay. And why are you so underweight the technology sector? Again, I was looking at a report, and apparently since the great financial crisis, it's delivered 38% of the... of the 40% that nearly all the return of the S&P 500 over that sort of like, you know, longer period. And it was just quite an interesting, is it valuation story that you've decided it's to sort of top slice?
Valuations, and it is a risk just being in everything that had run up together. Those stocks tend to fall together. And that was our thinking of getting out of some of the semiconductors in Novo Nordisk last month. That completely different drivers for these things, but there is a correlation between successful stocks that all ran up together do tend to send off together. So we wanted to move into some of the relative laggards. We bought 3M, we bought Roche, we bought ServiceNow, and moved away some of the previous high flyers. So still getting very similar growth, trading at a bit of a discount because they've not performed as well is really the thinking there.
Yeah, okay. We've got just a question on the sort of consumer discretionary on lodging from Nigel Batty Symes. He's asking about Whitbread. Have you ever had a look at those? They're basically the Premier Inn franchise. They also do, I think it's Beefeater pubs and stuff, sort of what they're actually converting some of them to rooms. The shares have sort of like sold off quite hard, actually, of late on concerns of sort of discretionary spend for consumers. But I guess they're a bit of a poster child and sort of like a go-to hotel provider, certainly for people like me if I'm traveling into London.
It's not one I've looked at very closely, but that would be fit the bill of what I just described, is looking at some relative laggards that maybe you're going to see some improved cost cutting, a focus on shareholder value. I don't think it's less competitive and better pricing power in the hotel side of things than it is in the airline side of things. So that is something I'd be much more attracted to, but it's not one I own and I can really comment on meaningfully.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'd say Nigel, the thing to watch is actually their German business, because I think they're indicating that it's going to be profitable. It's sort of like they've been building that for 2 or 3 years. It's going to be profitable in the next 12 months. And once that gets to critical mass, even though it's more competitive in the German market, then if they can replicate this UK model out in Germany, then they'll make significant returns. So still work in progress, but if they get that right, there'll be plenty of upside. Okay, brilliant, Patrick. Now, just finally then, sort of, you've done so well, you built your portfolio has over the last, well, since inception. How do you see the sort of, what should investors expect going forward from your sort of funds? Because you can't just keep knocking the ball out of the park every week.
We definitely don't do it every week. We've had some some terrible months relatively and some very good months relatively. But over the medium term, I don't think anything's changed over decades and decades. Companies that are cheaper than the market, that are growing faster than the market and seeing relative strength in their profitability are companies that are going to outperform. And our whole process is designed to highlight those companies to own and highlight the opposite kind of companies that are expensive, that have deteriorating fundamentals, negative revisions, insider selling. Those are companies that I think underperform. And we've designed our process and our systems to highlight both of those kind of companies. And any given month, it may not work, but over any medium term period, we do think markets are rational enough to really reward those companies with those winning characteristics and punish the companies that have the losing characteristics. And it's very much a common sense approach using what we think is very cutting edge. And the AI and the machine learning just allows us to do what hundreds of analysts used to do much more efficiently with our machines.
Well, if you ever decide to white label at that AI package you've got there, Patrick, then you can put me down as a customer, okay? And I'm sure plenty of other investors will be interested in taking some of that insight. That's for sure. You'll be the Armstrong sort of Reuters feed type of stuff into everybody's sort of like living rooms.
I'm sure it's not far away. If it's not us, I suspect these kind of things are going to be getting rolled out much more frequently. It's much easier to do than it was years ago. 10 years ago, it would have been impossible. 6 years ago, it was very difficult, but technology is continually improving. And I do think this is going to become much more mainstream.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thanks again, Patrick, and look forward in touching base probably in about 6 months' time. So best of luck with all the investing.
You too.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.